Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Millions of Americans are living with cancer, and some very publicly. Elizabeth Edwards, Tony Snow, and Fred Thompson, who thought they had won their battles with the disease, are coping with reoccurrences. These latest high-profile cases show how American attitudes towards cancer have changed, from something that could only be whispered to a disease that can be conquered. New treatments are allowing patients to live with certain types of cancer, and the survival rates are better than ever. This hour, On Point, living with cancer in America and combating the disease. Joining me now from Washington, Dr. Bernadine Healy, health editor for U.S. News and World Report and the magazine's On Health columnist. She's the former head of the National Institutes of Health and the Red Cross and a brain cancer survivor. Her new book is Living Time, Faith and Facts to Transform Your Cancer Journey. Dr. Healy, so nice to speak with you again.
Nice to speak to you, Jane.
Joining me in the studio is Dr. Eric Weiner. He's director of the Oncology Breast Center at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. Dr. Weiner, so good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here.
Dr. Healy, I'd like to begin with you. And if you would tell us a bit of your personal story. 8 years ago, you were diagnosed with a rare brain tumor. Do you remember what first went through your mind when you heard the word cancer?
Well, I think I was like every patient who hears the C word. I was stunned. I was shocked. How could this be happening to me? Allegedly, I did all the right things, the things I preached to my patients. And then you immediately are faced with the fact that this is what it is. You're going to have to deal with it. Your family's going to have to deal with it. And the only reason why I even discuss my own personal experience is that I guess there is a certain intense experience as a physician to actually be in your patient's shoes. And I've always thought I was empathetic, but I believe that cancer is a special experience, and it's one that certainly led me to believe that those of us who have this experience are more common and more similar than we are different.
So your training as a doctor or your work with people at the American Red Cross didn't bring you any strength or solace, a feeling of knowing sort of what you were getting yourself into?
Well, in my career in medicine, I was trained as a cardiologist and have been with patients at their most difficult moments with their families. And I think it did give me a certain strength, a certain understanding, a certain recognition that, wait a minute, why not me? I've seen so many who have gone through these devastating illnesses of many sorts. Why in the world should I be spared? On the other hand, I also perhaps knew too much and could read the kind of gloomy statistics. Mm-hmm. And I, like any patient, you know, kept reaching out and looking for that one report that would give me some sign of hope.
I remember reading where you said all I could think was, this is how I die.
Well, that's right. And I think most people who are given the diagnosis, even if it's a very early cancer, that goes through their mind, and it goes through the minds of their loved ones, of their family, their friends, and is often an unspoken thing that goes on in their social contacts. And I think that has to change. I think people have to quickly change their mindset from this is going to be my dying time to this is my living time. Whatever this future has in store for me, this is my living time, and no one's going to take it away from me. No dreary statistics. You know, I don't want to. I will do what I have to do. I will take this on. I will not give in any way that I can possibly do it, whatever I can control, but I recognize that this will be my living time until the moment it isn't.
in this piece in U.S. News and World Report, you tell this extraordinary story of the surgery to remove the tumor from your brain. You were actually awake during the procedure, and a 4 to 5 inch window was opened into your skull, and you were actually reading. I couldn't believe it. You were reading during the operation. Is that right?
Well, yes. You know, it, in a way, and I look back on it, and I think how sort of sad it was. You know, any patient who has cancer, including me, including doctors, including people who think they know a lot about cancer takes control of you. I mean, you lose control of something that's in your body in a way that you never really understood before. And being able to read during the surgery kind of made me feel, well, at least I could be part of the team. You know, I could help that surgeon not go into dangerous areas and take away my ability to speak. And
so you were actually sort of guiding him in a way as you were reading, knowing, well, I'm not in the wrong area of the brain. Is that right?
Well, you know, when I was in medical school, I remember hearing about Carvey Cushing and was so amazed that surgeons could operate on the brain itself, and not have pain. And in fact, years ago, you know, Harvey Cushing was doing it up in Boston, 100 years ago. And it was amazing. And here I found myself in that same predicament and proving him right. The brain can feel pain that is of emotional and psychological dimension, but it doesn't feel the physical pain of a scalpel. So I was able to do this without a physical pain and focusing on maybe helping out and protecting whatever I could protect, controlling what I could control. It turned out to be something very positive. And I know when people read this, they comment on, ooh, how awful. But in fact, it was my little attempt at grasping some control. And I think all patients want that and should be given that wherever it's possible.
So it's been 8 years, Dr. Healy. How are you doing and what's your prognosis?
Well, you know, you never know. You don't. As far as I'm concerned, this is my living time. I'm not going to. I have faith in and so feel so blessed at the past 8 years that have enabled me to see my preteen and teenage daughters grow up. One got married this weekend to a wonderful man, my wonderful husband, and I'm so thankful for the time that I have had, which has been longer than was predicted, and I look forward and have the faith that I will have wonderful living time ahead of me. But I do not sit and say, when am I destined to die? Because no one knows that. That's a lot of hubris. And any doctor who tells you when you're going to die, go and find another doctor. We doctors have been humbled so many times by thinking that someone is going to leave this world on schedule and others that are going to be there forever, and we have been proven wrong. So I think it's always a mistake to say that you are immortal or you strive to immortality. I am blessed for what I have so far, and I have faith in my future, whatever the good Lord makes it to be.
Let me turn to Dr. Eric Weiner, a director of the Breast Oncology Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Weiner, I keep reading that medicine is surging into this new phase of cancer treatment, that doctors and researchers are on the cusp of a treatment revolution. And yet last week, the American Cancer Society issues this dire warning that progress on the cancer front is actually slowing. So where do we stand in the fight against cancer?
So it depends on how you look at it. If you look at it over the course of the past 20 years, there's been tremendous progress, and there are more patients who are cured of their cancer diagnoses. And as important, there are more and more people who are living and living well with cancer that may be in advanced stages. But at the same time, medicines, sometimes chemotherapy, sometimes other medicines, are controlling the cancer. And we also have far better supportive care approaches than we did at one time, so that whereas many years ago people would receive chemotherapy and would be horribly sick, they can often receive these treatments now and go on with quite normal lives. That said, we have a long way to go. Cancer is a complicated problem. It varies by organ and even within certain sites. So, for example, breast cancer, which is the area that I deal with, breast cancer isn't one disease. It's many, many different diseases, and we're learning that and learning that those different diseases actually need to be treated somewhat differently.
I hear you say the word, and I sit across from you, and I physically feel fear when you say the word cancer, and I think a lot of people do. Is there a sea change, though, sort of generally and culturally in how we think about the word cancer and how it affects us and how we live with it?
Well, I'd like to think that there's a sea change, although it's a slow change. And I think perhaps more than almost any other diagnosis, cancer does strike fear in people. People think about those they've loved and known with cancer who have died of it and have often died fairly difficult deaths. And even when reassured that a woman or a man has a very early stage cancer and is very, very likely to do well for a long, long time, if not be cured of it, it carries more fear than most other diagnoses. And that's something that I think many of us try to change. And for those people who have advanced cancer who we're taking care of on an ongoing basis, as Dr. Healy said, I think much of this is about trying to focus on living with the problem, not fearing every moment that you're about to die from it.
And as a doctor, what do you tell your patients about living with cancer? What's the number one thing you say to them as they move forward with this often terrible diagnosis?
So, you know, I think our challenge as doctors and as nurses and as other healthcare professionals is to try to help people live as normal a life as possible. And sure, there are people who have a diagnosis of cancer and who know that ultimately that probably is going to be what will take their life. And they may want to make some major change in their life. They may want to take a trip that they were planning to do in 20 years that maybe they shouldn't put off for 20 years. But most people who are leading fulfilling lives want to continue with those lives and want to live those lives as completely as they can. And to suddenly make an abrupt change as a result of having cancer, for many people, may not be the right choice. That said, we have to respect what different individuals want to do when they learn about this and help them through it.
We've heard a lot lately from some very public figures announcing their struggle and their fight with cancer. Elizabeth Edwards, speaking on Oprah Winfrey's television program on April 6th, says cancer patients must push forward in life regardless of the disease and its effects.
And I think that people don't understand. It's live until you die, however long that is. And that's my advice to people who are facing this diagnosis and to everybody else listening to it. Live until you die.
And former Tennessee senator and possible presidential aspirant Fred Thompson on Neil Cavuto's Fox News, he spoke on April 11th announcing that he is in remission for lymphoma.
The day and age we live in, I mean, anytime you mention the C word, you know, it causes concern,
sure,
although a lot of people in politics have successfully dealt with it. And I wanted to make sure it wasn't misconstrued or the wrong story got out about it and what it was like.
And cyclist and cancer survivor Lance Armstrong, speaking last July on the Charlie Rose program, says, "We have the technology to treat a lot of cancers that kill people unnecessarily.
And I think we should provide a certain level of care for everybody, almost like a cancer bill of rights, where it's, you know, this is what you're going to get. And again, it's very simple. It's what you know and what you do. And the delta between those two has got to come down."
Dr. Eric Weiner, let me ask you that, following up on what Mr. Armstrong said. Is there technology to treat cancers for people who die unnecessarily? Are people dying unnecessarily from cancer?
Well, I think people will die unnecessarily from cancer if we don't continue to fund the research that is absolutely critical. I'm not sure that I agree entirely with Mr. Armstrong that there are people over the past 5 to 10 years who have died because they haven't received the right treatments. Clearly, there's variability in medical care. Not all individuals have the same access to care. And we need to fight hard to make sure that everyone in the U.S., and for that matter, everyone around the world, has the same access to appropriate medical care. But much of our challenge and much of the reason that a person dies from cancer in the U.S. every minute is because we still don't have all the right treatments. And to get there, we really need to focus on what makes a cancer cell tick and then how to apply that in the clinic.
And does that need more funding, more money? Where does that lead you?
Well, you know, research follows money. And it takes money and it takes brain power to do research. And it is absolutely critical that at this time, when we have such a better understanding of what makes cancer cells grow and flourish and spread, and what potentially are ways that we can stop that, that we continue to accelerate the progress by pushing forward with the research.
You talk about research dollars. Living with cancer can cost a fortune, too, as you well know. 5 years ago, I was reading the statistics. Cancer drugs accounted for just 13% of what we spent on medication. This year, it's expected to nearly double to 22%. What is driving up those costs?
The drugs themselves are getting more and more complex, and more goes into developing those drugs. I think it's an unfortunate reality that the price for those drugs goes up, and that is something that as a society we're going to have to face and figure out how it is that we may develop many of these smarter drugs, these targeted drugs, without entirely breaking the bank. But it's also important to keep in mind that death from cancer costs a lot of money. So one statistic that I read is that cancer in 2005 actually cost the U.S. $210 billion, but of that, $118 billion, so a little more than half, was as a result of lost productivity. Cancer takes lives not just from older people, or takes life away from older people, but also from many younger people who would have gone on and lived very, very productive lives.
Dr. Bernardine Healy, I'd like to turn to you in Washington. I've read where you say when it comes to cancer, you don't have any patience for what you call, quote, backseat doomsday drivers. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it is the kind of rhetoric that one saw so visibly when Mrs. Edwards and her husband announced the cancer that she had recurred. And there was the sense that immediately she should drop out, you know, she would, you know, that her husband shouldn't be in the race. He's not going to get any financial contributions. How possibly could she not be with her children full time now that she has this recurrence? I mean, kind of sitting in the back, trying to tell her how to lead her life in a way that she doesn't want to lead her life, and her husband doesn't want them to have their life together changed. And at the same time, because of this doomsday scenario, now she has a serious problem. However, this is her life, and she's looking at statistics that were from yesterday's patients. She is on drugs and interventions that were not available for many of the patients who were being reported in the literature. She has every reason to say what she said, which is, I'm not going to let someone else tell me I'm going to die. I'm going to live until the moment that changes, and no one else should hang the crape for me. But I think, Jane, one of the important things is I think in part this reflects a certain ignorance on the part of the public on exactly what we've learned about cancer. The fact that cancer is a genetic disease, it's about not just one gene going wrong. It is as if the cancer cell rewrites your own genetic program to misbehave, and that our success with cancer is now being guided by information that we never had before. In fact, I will go a step farther than Dr. Weiner, who is absolutely right in his plea for keeping the pressure on discovery. We are really in a 21st century cancer war. It is going to be very different from last century because of the facts, not just the faith that we're going to do better, but the facts. I use the example, can you imagine treating high blood pressure if you didn't have a blood pressure cuff? You know, you just treated nosebleeds and a ruddy face. Or a surgeon operating on coronary blockages in the heart without an angiogram telling them which arteries are causing the problems. Well, that's a somewhat simplistic example, but when doctors get the genetic profile of individual cancers that can look identical under the microscope, what they'll see is very different mechanisms of behavior. One might be more aggressive. One might be more apt to spread. One might be responsive to one drug and not another. This is the essence of the targeted therapy that Dr. Weiner is talking about. And patients with or without cancer need to understand it, because when they understand it, they will see the majesty of this moment in time's cancer research and the importance of strategically focusing on it, as we did with the same passion and enthusiasm back in the early 1970s when we started the war on cancer. But this is a renewed war on cancer.
Dr. Weiner, I'll turn to you.
Well, I would support what was just said entirely. I mean, this is a time when we have so much of a finer understanding of cancer. Again, as Dr. Healy said, cancer is a genetic disease. We are trying to understand exactly what makes a cancer cell work and spread. And of course, we're learning about all of the genes that go wrong in an individual cancer cell, and it's typically not one gene. It's many, many genes that have gone awry. And what we then need to do is match the appropriate treatment to the appropriate cancer and the appropriate molecular abnormality in that cancer. But it's not always so simple, and it's why research, which in the past we might think of as research in breast cancer or research in colon cancer, now we're thinking about research in small subtypes of these cancers. And it's going to take some very sophisticated science and a great deal of collaboration between clinicians and scientists and, perhaps most importantly, patients.
We talk about the research. We talk about treatment. I'd like to ask a very sensitive question about mindset, because I keep hearing people say, don't turn this into a dying time. You know, the word incurable should never be used. I don't think it should be used. I'm going to live through this. I'm going to make it. And with some experience, having watched my own brother die of a brain tumor, I say, you know, keeping your spirits up is important. Having the right attitude is important. But at some point, do you have to accept the truth that no matter how upbeat you are, no matter how happy a face you put on this, that cancer is going to kill you? And the guilt that comes from a loved one who said, well, if I just had the right attitude, or if I'd just been more upbeat or more positive, things would have turned out differently. You know, can you speak to the balance, doctor, between a positive outlook and a realistic approach to mortality?
So I think that Mrs. Edwards has actually said publicly in the press that she thinks that cancer will eventually take her life. So that what's different now than what was before is that she now knows that this may be the cause of her death. I think many people hope that that won't be the case, but it's certainly quite likely given the diagnosis. And I think that many people accept that fact. On the other hand, one can't live one's entire life with death right in front of you. You have to go on a day-to-day basis. And while on the one hand, you do have to accept the fact that at some point in time, this cancer may limit your life. And of course, if the prognosis is particularly poor, it's important for people to have some understanding of that if they choose to. And most do choose to have some understanding. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that a person should get into their bed, pull the covers over their head, and say, I'm ready to die. And most people don't want to do that. And the truth is, the last time I talked to people, or talked to anyone, people don't say that they want to know the moment they're about to expire.
I'd like to turn to the phones for a moment, because Lori is calling from Kennebunkport, Maine, in a very unusual circumstance. Lori, you're on the line.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, actually, I'm from Kennebunkport, but my husband and I came down to have an MRI at Dana-Farber, so I'm in the library here at Dana-Farber, coincidentally, and I had heard about, I went online to do some research on my husband's brain tumor. He has a glioblastoma multiforme, stage 4, and he's had two craniotomies. He got it in October, the end of October. He's showing some symptoms of it possibly recurring. And I know what Elizabeth Edwards said. May I keep speaking? Or?
Yes, please.
Hello? She said that you have to live every day that you that you're alive, but I think that especially for people taking care of people like I am, my husband, it's also important that we know that we can live with ourselves come what may. And for me, it's important that I know that I'm doing everything I can to the utmost. And what Dr. Healy said about how important it was for her that she in some way she knew too much. Well, we had just gone nonstop into trying to understand, you know, the implications of this, what we can do, and whether we're doing enough, whether we should add alternative therapies to the traditional therapies. And we've gotten so much great information, but then how do we prioritize it all? And I believe we're at the best place we can be. And Dr. Drapotz is my husband's doctor, and he's been incredible. And we picked Dana-Farber because they didn't try to tell us less than we needed to know. He's been honest every time I've talked to him, and Lisa Dougherty, the nurse practitioner here, and I just thank them very much.
Well, thank you for your call, and our best to your husband. I appreciate your words and your call. Thank you, Lori, very much. I want to turn to Benita. She's in Nashua, New Hampshire. Benita, you're on the line.
Hi, Dane. Thank you for having me on your program. It's
sure.
absolutely marvelous.
Thank you. What are your thoughts?
I'm 3 weeks out of my third rescission on a major cancer, and my investigation at this point, because of its recurrence, is at what point the doctors can find the pivot to saying it is now an end-of-life issue. I do believe, as opposed to Dr. Weir, that we must live our lives constantly aware of death being at hand. I think it makes for a more intense life experience. Thank you very much.
Benita, thank you. Dr. Weiner, would you like to respond?
So I wasn't suggesting that we shouldn't lead our lives understanding that death is something that could be something we confront at any moment in time. And I think that we all realize that tragedy strikes and that horrible things happen. I mean, we can look to Virginia to see what happened yesterday. On the other hand, I don't know that what a patient wants is a prediction of the day on which she or he is going to die. And I don't think most people want to live their lives knowing just when that's going to happen.
Dr. Healy, you talk a lot about the fact that cancer is one of the few experiences in your life that you fundamentally faced on your own. Is that really how you felt, that this was a solitary journey for you?
Well, what I said is that I think ultimately the cancer journey is a solitary journey. However, it is one that very much involves those who you love and those who surround you. You know, their foundations are shaken too, as Lori so clearly expressed in her comments a few minutes ago. But there is, you know, you birth and you die. Those are two solitary experiences. And I think that's what I was trying to say, that people can try and your loved ones can try and understand. But ultimately, what's in your heart and your head is something you can never convey and shouldn't ever try and convey. I think that there's a wonderful thing I talk about in my book where I do try and discuss the fact that at some point we do confront dying. That doesn't mean you live every moment thinking about dying, but it means, of course, you deal with it and you know people are realists ultimately. It was a wonderful quote that Stuart Alsop wrote in a book that was written about 30 years ago. He said, "A dying man must die like a sleepy man must sleep. They know when it happens, but you don't when that moment comes, it comes. But you don't spend your life constantly in fear of that moment coming. I can tell you, in a career in taking care of very sick patients with heart disease, we never would tell a patient who had terrible aortic stenosis, well, you have a 50% of not being here in 5 years. Some of the statistics for patients with heart failure are much worse than some of the worst of cancers, but we don't focus on that. We focus on what we can do and making people have the best quality of life. And when that moment comes, the patient knows it, the doctor knows it, and it isn't something that extends for 5 years. It's something that's over a relatively short period of time.
So many people are lined up on the phones wanting to join us. I'd like to turn for a moment to Beth, who's in Newcastle, New Hampshire. Beth, hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Jane. I just wanted to check in. 21 months ago, I was diagnosed with stage 3C of a very aggressive and rare form of ovarian cancer, which, of course, stopped my heart momentarily. I'm also happy, Dr. Weiner, to say that I've been involved with raising money for the Dana-Farber for the past 15 years.
Thank
you. He's smiling.
And so, well, I rode last year, 1 year after my surgery, as my victory ride. But my point is, I made a speech at the Czech presentation for the Penn Mass to the Dana-Farber. And my closing line was, I am not sick with cancer, I'm not suffering from cancer, and I'm not a victim of cancer. I'm living with it, and that has been the most important thing to me and my friends, family, all of my supporters. I need for them to believe that, too, because that's the single most important thing to me. I don't want to have someone come up to me with those soulful eyes and say, oh, how are you? Mm-hmm. I'm fine. I'm on my way to work. I was traveling all last week for work. I'm living my life to the fullest I can.
Good for
and
you.
I don't intend to stop.
Thank you.
I do not intend to stop.
Thank you, Beth, for those comments. We appreciate it. Dr. Weiner, you want to jump in?
So I have done that cycling event 8 times myself, and it's a great event, and thank you for riding in it. If any of my patients are listening, this line will sound familiar, but I always tell people that apart from their children and their parents, if they're providing more support to the person they're telling about their own cancer diagnosis than is being provided to them, then probably that's not a relationship that's going to help them a lot at the moment. And I think all too often people find that they tell someone they have cancer and that person is sobbing and they're there saying, it's really okay, I'm living my life. And I think you really emphasize that point perfectly. I want to just make one other quick comment, which is that I think all too often people feel that they suddenly have to become experts in cancer when they're diagnosed with cancer. And in a sense, they do. On the other hand, I go to a muffler person to fix my car, and I don't know a lot about mufflers. I try to learn a little bit, perhaps. And I think that it is absolutely critical that people find doctors and other healthcare professionals who they're comfortable with and with whom they can have a very solid relationship. And I'm not suggesting that someone should put all their faith in one individual by any means, but you do have to seek out those relationships with doctors and nurses that work for you.
Find the right team for you, the right support for you.
Absolutely.
Beth, our last caller, talked about how she doesn't want people feeling sorry for her. Dr. Bernadine Healy, let me bring you in because I know you've called for an etiquette of cancer. Tell me about that, doctor.
Well, I think, again, partly it's the fact that people are so uncomfortable with the word cancer, uncomfortable seeing someone who has just been diagnosed with cancer, and that often there is just abominable etiquette. I mean, things like someone coming up and saying, well, you know, you don't look so bad for someone who's dying, or I hope you don't suffer too much. And you are often in a position, just like Beth is saying, of trying to console other people, or also saying, "Hey, listen, I'm here. Look at me. I'm not in a coffin. I'm here." Mm. You know, you don't. In fact, I have a dear friend who is an oncologist herself. When she got cancer, she refused to tell anyone. She went to another place to get her treatment because she was afraid it would hurt her professional career because people would look at her and write her off. And she already was a tenured professor, but she was fearful that opportunities would be closed to her. That's bad etiquette. It's bad thinking. It's biased thinking. It's discrimination. And I think people have to get over that hump. You take people who they are and you praise their heroism and then you I'm still me, you know, and that's what they want to hear. They don't want you. And Dr. Weiner is giving the right advice. He's saying if you spend your time trying to make them feel better about your illness, you know,
not the right friend.
That's not good etiquette.
Yeah. Linda is calling from Middletown, Rhode Island. Linda, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Jane. I'm delighted to be a part of this conversation.
Thank you.
I am the founder and director of a nonprofit in Middletown, Rhode Island that serves women with cancer, a free nonprofit. And I'm compelled by this topic, as you can imagine. And the greater population of the women we serve here are women with metastatic disease, meaning their cancer has come back, then they're living with cancer as a chronic illness. And recently, I wrote a play called Chemo Brain, which has been performed all over, and it addresses every little thing we're talking about. I wish we could just perform it on this radio. But, you know, it's like a very intimate look into a Tuesday support group, which is the women with metastatic disease. And it's how, you know, people may say the wrong things. It's what they need. It's what they want to hear. It's how they want to tell people, I'm managing my life, not my death. It's how they want to pull the covers over their head one day, and you know what? It's okay, because tomorrow they're going to take the covers off their head and go about their life. And it's also just an amazing testimony to the human spirit, how these women say, you know what, I may not be able to control that cancer, but I can control some things. I'm going to take my kids to Disney. I'm going to say what's on my mind. I'm going to tell people I love them all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm going to help this other woman in our support group, which is a support group quite literally of sisterly love, with their prescription bills, because it's a sin that any woman should have to pay for any of her treatments. And it's for anybody to want to learn about life, if they could sit in or see the play, actually, there's a website, chemobrain.net. Just sit with somebody who has metastatic cancer. They know about life. Mm. Linda, know about life.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your call. I know Dr. Weiner wants to jump in and respond.
Well, no, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I just can't resist coming back to the research issue and the need for better treatments, because although for many women and men, cancer is a disease that can be managed over time and has become a chronic illness for at least a subset, a chronic illness that in many cases isn't more severe than, for example, diabetes, but for many, many other people, it is still a much more life-threatening disease and ultimately one that takes people's lives. And I think it emphasizes why we desperately need new and better treatments.
Jane, could I?
Please, Dr. Healy.
On that? You know, 2 points. First of all, I think your last caller, what she's saying is one thing you can control. You may not be able to control that cancer, but one thing you can control is your attitude. And sure, you'll have your down days. No one should deprive them of you of that. But ultimately, your attitude is to embrace life. But the second thing, getting back to Dr. Weiner's comment, his important comment about metastatic disease, this is an area where we have not been been having the great investment that we have in other areas. And metastatic disease there tends to be more common. Many cancers, when they get to that stage, particularly the carcinomas, they kind of all start to look alike when they spread to different organs. And I think I talk about faith in cancer. And one of the things when I kind of reflected on why aren't we doing better with metastatic cancer, so often you hear even from scientists and oncologists who have seen so many people struggle with this, well, it's just too tough a problem or it's too late. And I always come back with a challenge, which is there are two examples in which metastatic cancer has gone to from the original organ to the lungs, to the brain, to the belly, and yet it has been cured with chemotherapy. And one is a rare tumor in women called choriocarcinoma. It is basically a cancer of the placenta most of the time, and it occurs in young women who used to die in very short period of time. The second is Lance Armstrong's cancer, testicular mm-hmm. cancer. Mm. And one of his messages that sometimes doesn't get he said it, but sometimes people don't realize, this is a man who had metastatic cancer. His cancer had gone from his testicle to his belly to he was coughing up blood from lung tumor. It was in his brain. And these two cancers, now they have their own unusual twist. They're so-called germ cell tumors. But we have found a way to cure metastatic cancer of these types. If we can do it in these cancers, I have the faith and I have the belief in discovery and in science that we can do it for other cancers. And we are on the brink of being able to do it because we understand, we're getting to understand again this genetic and protein map of these tumors to understand their vulnerability. We're also learning about stem cells, which may be critical as tumor initiators that we have never before that turn cancerous, and we've never before targeted them. So I think that there is a whole new opportunity to go after metastatic disease, and we have to look at it positively, not be discouraged by it.
Let me jump in. We have made great advances, and you both referred to that, but what are, Dr. Weiner, the cancers that are still of biggest concern, that are the biggest threat?
Well, the cancers of their biggest concern are the most common cancers still. So breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer. These cancers all take a huge number of lives. And we are going to need interdisciplinary approaches that will bring clinicians and scientists together. And the truth is, we have those teams ready to work. And I keep coming back to this funding issue and the need for research. And let me state it very, very plainly that the NCI budget, the National Cancer Institute budget, has been flat for the past several years. And when a budget is flat, that essentially means that there is a decline in funding because of increases in cost of living. And it's estimated that, in fact, in real dollars, we have 12% less to spend on cancer research today than we did several years ago. And in my view, given all that's going on in the laboratories around the country and around the world, and given the ability to bring clinical medicine to the laboratory to clinical medicine, this is just a travesty. And this is the time to step on that cancer research accelerator, and we just have to move it forward.
A practical question from Carrie in Burlington, Vermont. Carrie, hello to you.
Hi. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a mammogram that revealed punctate calcifications, and so I'm starting on process. And the mammogram was done at a rural hospital, and so I'm looking to go now to a regional center that has more facilities. And I would like some pragmatic advice on how to choose a physician.
Carrie, thank you. Either one of you, Dr. Healy, Dr. Weiner, want to jump in? What's the process?
Well, I think Dr. Weiner is the head of a breast institute. I will defer to you, though I have my views.
Dr. Weiner?
Well, you can certainly never go wrong going to a major cancer center and an NCI-funded cancer center. There are, of course, many fine doctors in many, many community hospitals. It's just a little harder to know for sure exactly what one is getting into in that situation. I think that it's all up to you and what works with your lifestyle. And if you want to go someplace locally or regionally and see how that feels, and then move on if you feel like you're not getting the care and the answers that you need. And that, of course, is what a lot of people do. I think the more complicated the cancer, the greater the need for someone to come to a larger center. And one of the issues in terms of coming to a larger center is there are simply teams in place, teams that cross disciplines that can essentially gather together around an individual with cancer and surround them with care and surround them with perhaps the best recommendations.
Is it fair to say, and this is a tricky question, but you come to a center like this and your chances of recovering or curing your cancer are better, Dr. Weiner?
Well, look, I mean, that's what all of us who work in places like Dana-Farber would like to believe. Of course, different patients come to major cancer centers than those who are treated in community hospitals. And I think it's really hard to say that for sure the outcomes are better at a large cancer center. What there is no question of in my mind, though, is that the more complicated the situation, the greater the need for a higher level of expertise. I think the other thing just to mention is that clinical trials, which very frequently are asking questions about new treatments, treatments that may be better than our present and standard treatments, are something that patients should consider early on in the course of their illness. Clinical trials aren't right for everyone. There isn't a clinical trial for every patient. And we don't know for certain that receiving care as part of a clinical trial is necessarily better care. But it should be at least as good care, if not better care, than receiving standard treatment.
I have a couple of minutes left. And Dr. Healy, perhaps I'll give you the last word and ask you to leave us with something that you'd like people to know about cancer, perhaps about your own experience or something that Americans should know if they have this experience or know someone who does.
Well, I think that cancer is a common cause. There is not one of us who will be spared, either through having cancer themselves or a family member, a dear loved one. And I think any of us, any listener today just has to look at their own family and their own loved ones, and I think they know that's the case. And I think that this is a journey. It is a journey of faith, and it is a journey of facts. And I think that the best advice I would give to people is to focus on both and to become informed before, if you get the diagnosis, if someone you love has it, and never to lose faith in yourself and in your medical team and in the future and your future.
Dr. Bernadine Healy joining us from Washington today, health editor at U.S. News and World Report, former head of the National Institutes of Health and the American Red Cross, herself a brain cancer survivor. Her new book, Living Time, Faith and Facts to Transform Your Cancer Journey. Dr. Bernadine, thanks so much for your time. Great to see you again.
Thanks, Jane.
And Dr. Eric Weiner, the director of the Breast Oncology Center at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute here in Boston, associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Wonderful to have you. Thank you for your comments, Dr. Weiner.
Thanks for having me.
We leave you today with a performance by Melissa Etheridge during the 2005 Grammy Awards, who took the stage on the heels of treatment of breast cancer herself. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.